MSW Media.
For most of us, democracy has been a spectator sport.
Prevail, це щотижнева програма про політику.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimine organizzato, dinero sucio.
Globale corruzione. Та боротьбу за демократію.
E ora?
A тепер?
E maintenant?
Con ustedes, su anfitrión.
Regolier.
Welcome into the fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Robbie Harris is here. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Therapy Online. If you want to live a more empowered life, therapy can get you there. Visit betterhelp.com/Greg today to get 10% off your first month. If you like what I'm doing on the podcast, please subscribe, review, download, and share episodes with your friends. The Prevail column on Substack has been going since November of 2019. Lots of stuff in the archives about Leonard Leo, Brett Kavanaugh, Jared Kushner, Putin, Trump, Russia, Ukraine, much, much more. Every piece of Prevail is free to read and always will be. No paywalls ever. Your generous support keeps it that way. Subscriptions are just $6 a month, $55 a year. Visit gregoliar.substack.com to learn more. Robbie Harris is a strategic communications and behavior change subject matter expert. We'll get into that in the interview. With over 25 years experience working with local influencers, activists, civil society organizations, journalists, and senior stakeholders in Iraq, Syria, Africa, and Central America. She's designed and implemented successful programs for the United States Department of Defense, Department of State, and USAID, and the UK FCDO and MOD. She's the co-founder of a small international business, has worked for USAID OTI, speaks Arabic, Spanish, and English, obviously, and has an MA in Arab Studies from Georgetown University. I really had a good time talking to her because she's been places and done things that I didn't even know you could go do, where she's running, like, you know, strategic communications is basically combating propaganda that's coming out of some of these places. Like, so she's worked extensively combating that. We'll get into that in the interview. We cover a lot of ground. We talk about, first of all, her background and how she got into this line of work, which is interesting. And then we talk about the places she's been and what she's been doing. So we spent a lot of time, as she did in Iraq, talking about the situation there. You know, what she did and also what's going on now. We talk about Syria also. As you know, people listen to the podcast and I'm fascinated by Syria. So we talk about that, what's happening now, maybe how the borders that were drawn up at the end of the First World War by the British and the French have impacted the situation there today, the borders between Iraq and Syria, and how they're just sort of maybe don't make sense so much in terms of the people that live there. We talk about Kurdistan. There's a refugee camp in northern Syria, which I was unaware of, that we get into. You know, that's going to be a big challenge for the international community, I think, in the days to come. And then we talk about her experience living in Somalia and Niger. And last, we get into the whole situation with the Moscow bombing and ISIS-K. And then at the end of the interview, we talk about democracy. And, you know, I've talked a lot on this show. I've written a lot about the threat to democracy that a second Donald Trump administration would put us in, what that means, et cetera, et cetera. She really offers a great perspective on this because she's been in these places where democracy is dead. And she sees how it is to live in these corrupt, horrible regimes. And when I asked her to explain it and get into the details, I think she does a really great job of really articulating what we have to lose if this guy wins. And, you know, if there's some sort of civil war, which everybody seems to be excited about, what that would mean in practice. And it ain't pretty. So this is not something that we want. Anyway, it was great to talk to her. I really enjoyed the conversation. You will too. We'll have that for you in a minute. Okay, so this weekend, I drove up to the North Country to see my friend LB, and I stayed with her, her family, Sunday night. And Monday, we took in the eclipse because where I live in New York, we only had like 95%. But where she lives, there was totality. I love the word totality, and I've been running around saying it for the last week. I probably will have to stop soon because it's not a word that you really encounter much in life outside of eclipse season. But she was in the path of totality. And I thought to myself, you know, people fly to foreign countries. They fly around the world. They make these long pilgrimages to go see the full solar eclipse because it happens so rarely. And I thought, why can't I just get in my car and drive 3 hours? It's not a big deal. It'd be ridiculous. If I don't do this, it's just stupid and I will regret it. So I did. And, you know, I'm not usually adventurous in this sort of way. Not that driving, you know, upstate New York is adventurous particularly, but it did take me, it's a 3.5 hour drive. It took me 8.5 hours to drive home because the traffic was just, you know, insane. It was like we're all fleeing the zombie apocalypse or something. The rest stops were, I can't even explain what they look like. They were like, you know, zombie movie set pieces. Even the traffic part was okay because I felt like everybody that was driving down south from the North Country, they were there for the same reason. You know, we were all there to see the eclipse, this wonderful, amazing feat of nature that, you know, it's just, you're sitting around, everything's fine. And then suddenly, you know, the moon starts to move over the face of the sun, which if you don't have your glasses and you don't know it's coming, maybe you don't even really notice. I mean, that was the one thing that was amazing is even when the moon had blocked the sun, maybe, you know, 85-90%, it was still light out. It was still like, you know, brighter than twilight even. I mean, it was, you know, there was light. The sun is holy shit powerful, right? And even when you get the full coverage, which looks like, you know, when you go to the eye doctor and they're testing your eyes, there's a little device that you look into, they make you look into, and it has a ring of light with a dark center. And that's what it looks like, but it's just, you know, on a cosmic scale. And once you hit totality, and you can't do this unless you're in the path of totality, you can take off those eclipse glasses and look at it with your naked eyes for the 2.5 minutes or whatever it is that it's there. And, you know, it's amazing. It's like, it goes dark. The temperature really did drop like 9 degrees, something like that. The birds were going crazy. And, you know, it wasn't pitch dark, but it was dark and you could see Venus and you could see Saturn. And just like everybody said, and it was just amazing. You know, it was amazing. I was happy that I did it, happy to spend time with my friends. And, you know, if you have the chance to take in a full solar eclipse in its totality, I recommend that you take advantage of it. Because it was fantastic. You know, one of these things that's been going on forever on this planet and doesn't happen even on other planets. You know, when Elon Musk goes to Mars, he's going to be disappointed in the eclipses there because the moons are too small. The moon is 400 times smaller than the sun and 400 times closer to Earth than the sun. So they appear exactly the same size in the sky, which is why it can cover it completely like that. And it's just one of these weird quirks of nature that's just, it's just fabulous. It's awesome. Awe-inspiring. And, you know, I don't know. I just felt good since I saw the eclipse. I had a great weekend and, you know, I've just felt optimistic and hopeful and like things have shifted, you know. And maybe they have, maybe they haven't. I don't know. But it feels that way and it's nice for it to feel that way. And I drove 8.5 hours without stopping, which for me will also never happen again. And, you know, I wasn't even really that tired. I got home at 1 a.m. It was fine. It was fine. It was totally worth it. So anyway, thanks to LB for hosting me and thanks to the moon for blocking out the sun there for those 2 minutes so I could enjoy myself. Okay, way too much prattle up front. This is a fantastic show. Robbie is a wealth of information. She has so many interesting experiences and I had a lot of fun talking to her. So without further ado, we'll be right back. With Robbie Harris.
If they win, Michael Flynn will be back in charge. Donald Trump will round us up, load the Gitmo barge. They want bans on gays and trans and women's right to choose. Trump as POTUS, or Santa SCOTUS, Aileen Cannon or Ted Cruz. Hey, they're gonna take our rights away. Hey, they're gonna take our rights away.
Bobby Harris, welcome to Prevail.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited.
I'm excited too. You have now. You said before the show started, and in the lead into it, that you don't think your experiences are going to be that interesting. And I beg to differ. I think this is really fascinating because you've spent many years now going to places like Iraq and Syria and Somalia and places basically that most people don't want to go to at the moment, or at the times when you're there, they're not times that maybe tourists would like to go. So to me, that's very interesting. And the first question that I have before we get into the specifics of what you've been doing in these places and why you go there so frequently is, talk a little bit about your background. How did you get into this very specific niche line of work?
Oh, Greg. That's a story. So I'll start by saying it's funny. I think as humans, we don't change very much throughout our lives. If I look back about the things that I used to get in trouble for as a third grader in school, being late, talking too much in class, kind of getting off topic, I still get in trouble for the same things. They just have different ramifications. And if I look at how I started in my professional life, and what I went to college for and university for, and where I ended up, the outer trappings of it are very different and how it manifests, but the core element of it really is the same. I grew up in a very conservative Southern Baptist household in Virginia. And by the time I was 15, when I was 14, I told my mother I was going overseas as an exchange student. So I left about 6 days after I turned 15, lived in Australia for a year, came back, and was convinced I was going to be a missionary. So that's what I did. I was going to go convert people. And so I went to a small Southern Baptist school in Alabama, trained for that, got married, got a degree that would allow me to do that. And then I decided that I wanted to convert Muslims. So I went to grad school. Yes, convert them to Christianity. Like, I laugh now because in hindsight, it was a very, very bad idea. And I'm not trying to do that anymore. I should say that as a caveat, but... So I started doing the Arab Studies program at Georgetown in 1999, and I love languages. And the study program there was an Arab Studies program. It's not a Middle Eastern Studies program. It is an Arab Studies program. And at that time, because it was before September the 11th, it was largely about the Arab-Israeli conflict or oil. You kind of studied one or the other and a few things around it, but that was mainly what was on offer. Well, as I said, I was married at the time, had to pay for Georgetown because it's not cheap, and I didn't grow up with a lot of money. So I started bartending, and the first time I ever walked into a bar was when I applied for a job in one.
Oh, my God.
I went in, and I started working there to get money to support, you know, living expenses and things like that for school. And over time, I began to see that, like, the only way I can describe it, and I actually talked to conservative Muslims and Jews during this whole process who had a similar experience. What they said was that their experience of the world got bigger and bigger and bigger, which meant that the box that their religion or the interpretation of their religion had put God in got smaller and smaller and smaller. And I just realized that, A, I didn't know enough to run around the world trying to tell people how to live their lives, try to convince them to leave their religion and their culture for God only knows what reason. But and so all about the same time, I left my marriage, I left the church, and I finished my graduate studies. September the 11th had happened. I had received a fellowship, the National Security Education Fellowship, to study in Syria, and I owed the government a year of time. And they allowed me to pay it back in Iraq. And even before that, I had been to Iraq twice, once to protest the sanctions. I walked from the border of Jordan and Iraq to Baghdad. And then secondly, in a taxi cab with a friend who wanted to see it before we before the Americans bombed it, and ended back up there for work. But I always wanted to help people, and I always felt like that people, if given enough information, they make good decisions for themselves, right? And that really believe in the power of people to change their own lives and change their communities, and have never really thought, except for that brief period when I thought I should be telling people what to do with their spiritual lives, have never really thought that those answers could come from outside. And so once I started in Iraq, I started on a USA local governance project in Basra. And it's interesting, when we started there as the initial programs in Iraq, it was such a different place. I mean, what people often forget when you look at the mess that ensued afterwards and the destruction and the carnage and kind of the role that America played in that. But what a lot of people actually forget is that Iraq did live under a dictator for quite some time.
Yeah.
And so when we got there, like, they hadn't had new books in the library since the 1980s. Mm. And this is 2003, right? And one of the first things that people, because I was in Basra as a young, I think I was 28, 29 in Basra. One of the first things that people in Basra did was go to Kuwait, get newspapers, come back and post them on the walls.
Oh my God.
To the mosque, because they had not had access to information. Everything was censored coming in. So for instance, we ran a journalism training program, not because they didn't have journalists, but they did, but they hadn't touched a computer. It's 2003. And so we did a computer class. They didn't even know how to turn it on or what a file was, right? And they had been out of journalism for so long. So we ran an Arabic language class, not because they couldn't speak Arabic, but because they had been removed from actually, you know, language progresses, changes.
Right.
And so a lot of people forget this, but that's what it was like then. So I worked on a project. I worked on that project for a year. And then left that one and started working on another one to support the peace, justice, and security line of things. And then stayed there for about a year and a half, went home for a couple years, and came back and started working on a project that was designed to use communications to support the development of democracy in Iraq. And on that project, I worked, I had a mentor who was a sociologist who looked at all conflict as a social change project. Social change problem. And it was fascinating to look at it through his eyes. And in some ways, it brought back to mind some of the missionary work, but in the sense of how do you put yourself in someone else's shoes? How do you see how they're living? How do you understand what their trauma, what their interests, what their desires are? And how do you help people have access to the information they need to make better choices for their future? So that's how I got started.
That's all really interesting. And I think you said, maybe it's going to be run of the mill. It's very not run of the mill at all. My follow up question is, what bar did you work at? Because it seems like you went into the bar and your whole life changed. And
it did. So I don't know anybody who's familiar with Washington, D.C. There used to be a bar on DuPont Circle called Biddy Mulligan's,
okay,
just across from Kramer's Books. And it's in a hotel right there on the circle. And I had some wonderful managers there who really taught me what it meant to. Funny enough, the funny things you learn in a bar working there, but taught me to stand up for myself. You know, I had a manager who would always say, you're here to serve, but you're not here to be a servant. And I was raised in a way where you can let people walk all over you. You're just supposed to turn the other cheek. So I had no real ability to take care of myself, right? In the real world, it worked as long as you were at church and were only around church people, but take that attitude out in real world, people will walk right all over you.
Yeah. I don't know. Okay, I got to hang out there. I didn't go to DuPont Circle that much because it wasn't within walking distance of where I could stagger home. So you're an expert in strategic communications and behavior change subject matter. Mm-hmm. Do I have that right? Okay.
Yeah, somebody asked me to describe myself the other day in six words. I said I'm a strategic behavior change social strategist. There you go.
Okay, so what is that, and how does that apply to overseas places and stuff like that?
Right. So it's really, traditionally people would call it strategic communications, but I don't like that. It gets, I don't like it because people say, oh, propaganda, you're telling lies. And I'm like, no, telling lies. And The way that I see it functioning is within communities. So whether the objective is to mitigate polarization between two ethnic groups or two sects of religion, or whether or not it is to mitigate violent extremism or support the entrance of women into governance or to promote personal agency and get youth involved. And when I say youth, I mean 18 to 30-year-olds involved in changing and shaping their community, then you know, it could mean any of those things, but the process is the same. And what I've discovered is you have to start from the premise that nobody wakes up and says, gee, I'm going to go out and fuck up my life today the best way possible. Nobody does that. I look at people, sometimes I look at young people and I'm like, you really woke up this morning determined to screw your life up and you have set about all day to make all these decisions, right? But nobody really does that. But what we do is we live within a context and we understand ourselves in relation to our community and our community in relation to ourselves. We understand what it means to succeed, not necessarily because we know what it means to succeed for us, but because our community has said, if you're successful, you will do X, Y, and Z. And I teach a class sometimes to various people. And one of the things I say is, some people may take offense to this, I'm sorry, but imagine living in the hollers of West Virginia. If you want to succeed, there's a couple options that you see. It used to be the mines, maybe still is. Maybe you run meth, or maybe you work at like the country, local country store, right? The reality is there are a lot of scholarships out there. The same thing is for inner city kids, right? There's scholarships, there's routes, there's pathways. But if nobody in your family has ever sat down and helped you study for the SAT or ACT, if nobody has ever helped you fill out FAFSA forms, if your family doesn't even file taxes, right? Because they just don't. I mean, all these things, unless you have a kick-ass counselor, you're not going to know that it's an option. Do you have to be a genius, basically, a really high-functioning thinker to imagine something you'd never see? So we look at communities, we look at individuals, we look at their identities, their interests, their narratives, their networks, what makes up the social fabric of their lives, how does that drive their desires, demands, and disgusts? Why are people making the decisions they're making? The status quo always exists for a reason, and it fills a need. And so if you want people to shift their behavior, you have to shift social norms for sustainable, like, with kids, you can coerce people to do anything for a short amount of time and you can scare them to do something. If you really want to see deep change, you have to provide more information. You have to give people opportunities to experience new things. And that's whether you want people to mask or not mask during an epidemic, a pandemic, or, you know, you want people to put seatbelts on. Yeah. I don't know, but it's all behavior change.
So one of the things it says, because I looked at your little your CV, I suppose. So what is active learning feedback loop? What does that mean?
So basically, when you're trying these things, some things will work and some things won't work.
Okay.
Right. And when it comes to communications, I don't design content at all. Let me see if I can get this white. Right. I'm a white, cisgendered, almost 50-year-old woman. I am not going to be selling motorcycles to inner city children in Chicago. Like, it's just not going to work. So, you know, I mean,
you'd be surprised.
Maybe I could get creative, right? But I don't know. I don't think it's going to work. So what it means by active learning is when I do this, I think it's best to find influencers and people in the area who are kind of more or less on message with the same things and want to see the same changes, but maybe they're not networked together or they don't know about each other, and you bring them together. But once you start doing this, once you start providing the activities for people to engage in through small grants, or once you start doing the content, you have to look at what kind of reaction it's getting. Is it moving you towards your goals? And that's the other thing. You have to know what you want to do. Like, I was talking to someone the other day and they said, oh, well, I want to say this and I want to say that. And I'm like, that's great. But that's not a communications objective. What are you trying to achieve? Then we'll determine what you need to say and who you need to say it to, right? But only once you've done that, can you see if what you're doing is working. And if it's not, then you need to know it and you need to change it. They need to be lessons learned, not lessons observed.
This is interesting because your point about West Virginia, my father-in-law grew up in Lawrence, Michigan, which is way up on the Upper Peninsula. I mean, as far away from anything as you can imagine, and grew up in this very kind of, you know, town where, you know, his parents didn't go to school. There weren't that many options. And he figured out how to navigate the system, mostly because somebody down the street happened to have gone to school and became an engineer. And he was like, oh, I'm going to go do that. But if he hadn't met that guy, maybe he wouldn't have. So I think that's interesting. And it ties in with what you've been doing, which is finding people that know things and kind of pushing them together so that they're not collaborating, but at least aware of each other's existence, right? So, and we should add at this point, I think that the people you pushed communications on were ISIS, which, so now I know that, you know, ISIS, I guess they're in the news this week. We're recording this on the 24th. I thought Donald Trump killed all of ISIS, but I guess not. They're back. But you legitimately were taking it to ISIS, as I understand it. So talk a little bit. I don't know how much you can say, but talk a little bit about that and what that process was like.
Well, you know, when we first started talking to people and asking them, do you want to be involved in an effort to do this? Their immediate answer was no, it's too dangerous, right?
Yeah.
Because honestly, if you had looked, and I'm going to leave the location, I'm not going to say where it was because they were active in a bunch of different places. But if you looked at the social media sphere, even the media sphere, you know, the only narrative that you saw about ISIS was what they produced themselves and handed to CNN or Al Jazeera or BBC, or what they and their followers put out. There wasn't a whole lot to counter them or to offer an alternative, right?
Yeah.
And so you would think, looking at it, oh my God, everybody's an ISIS supporter. They're so big and strong. I mean, literally, they rolled across the desert with a couple, I mean, it was a little bit more than this, but a couple of trucks, a few RPGs, and scared a bunch of security forces who up and left, right? But that wasn't just all they were. They were perceived to be much bigger because of all of the social media and media around them, including what CNN, Al Jazeera, and BBC put out. Credible news sources telling real information, but only telling one side of it. So people said we're scared. We said, well, just try it, see what happens, right? And then once they got to know each other and realized we're not alone in this, and people liked their content, and it was everything from content that was humorous to content that would tell a story about maybe when ISIS was defeated, or it's funny, some of the best content we ever put out that opposed ISIS had nothing to do with battles, had nothing to do with beheadings, had nothing to do with any of that. And what it had to do with was reminding people who they are. So if your culture likes music and loves music, ISIS says music is abhorrent and you can't have it. So remind people who they are about the things that they love, that if this organization persists, you can't, this part of you, you have to shut down.
Yeah.
That's what we did.
It's so fascinating to me because I saw where I work, we acquired a, and I told you this before, a catch, I suppose, of these pamphlets from the first Gulf War that the CIA designed and dropped over, you know, into Iraq, basically to get people to surrender. And what you're doing or wind up doing, I think, is sort of not the same thing, but it's similar in that it's, you know, you're trying to get a message out, but it's way more high tech, obviously, than this stupid piece of paper, you know, being dumped on.
What I find interesting is usually when people want to counter something, you know, they don't really mean counter. They want to undermine the influence of someone else. They want to disrupt it. They want to interdict it, right? And so somehow, as humans, the thing we think is, oh, we just need to tell them they're wrong. We just need to tell them how bad this other side is. Well, I'm sorry, but if you've been living under ISIS occupation, you know how bad they are. You know how traumatizing it is. I don't need anybody to remind me. And in fact, if I see it, I'm going to turn it off because it's so traumatizing, right? And it disempowers people. It just makes people feel like, oh my God, they're so cruel. I can't do anything, right? But when you provide an alternative, a way for people to feel empowered in this situation, a way for people to take back just a little bit of their own personal agency, whether they're living under occupation or even outside and near it, so they don't feel as scared. Scared people can't organize themselves to do anything.
Yeah.
It's just trying to survive. And so when you give people something that they want to fight for rather than against, And I say, give it to them. We didn't give them anything, just reminded them. This is who you are. These are the things. These are your people. Come together. And it was done in a way by local people that made sense to whoever. You have your audience, other podcast people have their audiences, and you talk about different topics. And so each influencer knew how to, this was before influencers were even a thing, but each influencer knew how to talk to their own group, and they did in their own way.
It is fascinating that the idea of presenting something that they have to give up to live in that way, like with the music, because it reminds me of, I saw this book one time that we stayed at a B&B and they had the book there. Yeah. And it was just, I think it was just called Taliban, but it was a picture book, which you wouldn't think there would be. So what happened was these Taliban soldiers, I forget when exactly in the war it was, but after they had taken over and were controlling Afghanistan, they realized they needed pictures like for their passports and stuff. Like, there were certain things that they couldn't get around the whole graven images thing. So they went to this place and they allowed this one guy to shoot passport photos. And they wound up, you look at the photos and these guys are all, you know, their hair is all nice. They have coal on their eyes. They put like rouge on, like they're like made up and they're really artful shots. And you know, they have the guns with, I think there was flowers around. They were like as artful as a passport photo can be. And I think the place got blown up, I think everybody who got their picture taken is dead. And they found these pictures there. And some artist found them and kind of put them into this book. But it's the same idea. You don't think about the Taliban being like, oh my God, this is fun. They're essentially taking selfies and being like, this is wonderful. Wow. You know, just to your point about, you know, missing out on things, you know, why is that bad? I mean, objectively, you know, it isn't. Yeah. Have your fun. Yeah.
It makes me think of something too, is that how we as individuals assign meaning to things and how we make sense of the world around us, right? So I often give this example. It may be hearsay, but I think it's kind of true. If it's not, it's still a good story. But an aid organization went into a country in Africa and noticed that the women were walking about 2 to 3 hours every day to get water from a well in these certain areas. And so they go to the village and they say, do you need water? Well, if I ask you, Greg, do you need water to survive? What's your answer?
Yes.
Yeah, of course you do. Yeah. So they say yes. They say, okay, well, we're going to build you wells. Great. So they build wells near the villages. They're like, oh, this will save the women time walking, blah, 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 blah. Within 6 months, several of the wells were not functional.
Okay.
Guess who destroyed them?
The women.
Made them not functional. The women. Do you know why?
That I do not know.
The women did it because those 2 to 3 hours every day was the only time that they got to get away from the nagging in-laws and family and other people in the village, go hang out with their besties or their frenemies, whoever's in that group, but at least get away. Take the babies with you that are breastfeeding. Leave the toddlers that are constantly asking why at home with mama, and you go. And that was precious to them, that couple of hours. But from an outside perspective, we didn't assign. I say we, the international community, didn't assign that meaning to that time. What they assigned that time meant walking was hardship and pain.
Yeah.
For these women, it wasn't. So when we look at these things and when we try to understand what's happening somewhere else, it's really important to understand what meaning people assign to things. And I think you can even see that in our own country. So much of how we say and talk to one another, we talk past each other, especially in social media spaces, because we make assumptions about that people assign the same meanings to things that we do, and they don't.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because you do see that all the time in social media. And I think that's part of the, like, my inability to see, you know, when you're trying to process who the other side is on something, you try to get into their heads and, you know, think as they think, to try to empathize, right? And so I think about, you know, MAGA people and religious conservatives, and I don't understand it, because it just doesn't make sense to me. And the value, I think it gets to the point you're saying, where the values, they're not placing the same value on things that I am, and the assumptions are different. So You know, it's like it's a whole other bubble that I have not, you know, penetrated in my brain.
And another thing that we see a lot in the work that I do and in working with our staff, because the staff, we always have like 85% local staff, because it's just not, it's not, I don't think it's, I mean, like if I am ever working in a country and I want to leave, for the most part, I can, right?
Yeah.
But they can't. So I think it's really important to have them participate and drive the strategy and drive the implementation and, you know, raise concerns, flags. Best day in my life is when my staff come and tell me I'm wrong and tell me why and tell me what to do about it. I love it. It's great. But it's one of the things we teach is that it's not what I think about you that determines how I respond to you. It's what I think you think about me that determines how I interpret and respond to your actions towards me. And we're doing that all the time. And we don't think about it. And when you articulate it at first, it's like, huh, what do you mean? And you're like, oh, yeah. But the truth of the matter is we never really know when it's in someone else's head.
Yeah. Yeah. And they, I think people too, in general, not everybody, not narcissists maybe, but most people are insecure and think that other people are thinking about them way more than they actually are. I think most people are so self-absorbed with their own shit that they don't, they're not thinking about anybody else at all. Or if they are, it's a very fleeting thought about, oh yeah, nice person or whatever. And that's it. And somebody might say, oh, they looked at me funny and obsess over this for hours and hours when, you know, it's just nothing. So that's, that's an interesting point. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Okay. This is a good time, because I always forget to do this. This is a good time to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Robbie Harris.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp Therapy Online. For 10% off your first month, go to betterhelp.com/Greg. How is your social battery feeling right now? Drained? Mine feels a little bit better since the eclipse, but it's been rough lately, I'm not gonna lie. You know, the winter is hard, I think, socially. Just, I don't feel like getting out of my house that much. It's cold. And I think just in general, you know, the pandemic and having to be inside and adapt that way has made me personally just less social and less able to, you know, deal. And we have, I think, in this modern age, we have a lot of responsibilities. We have a lot of obligations socially. We spread ourselves thin, you know, and now it's the spring and people are going outside. There's more gatherings. You get invited to more things, which is great. There's like graduations, there's weddings, there's stuff going on. You know, what's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge, you know, when you're not feeling it? Maybe you're the kind of person who like thrives around people. Maybe you need, you know, more alone time. There's different kinds of people, different, you know, on the sliding scale of introvert, extrovert, you know, it's hard to know. And one way that you can know is to go to therapy and talk it through, because therapy can give you the self-awareness to build around a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And I think everybody can benefit from this. As you know, BetterHelp is great, and I've used it before. You know, it really helped me get through a time that was not only emotionally hard, but hard to even articulate what my problem was to a normal person, because it was like related to my being on social media, which is another form of social, by the way. Social media, you know, for all of human existence until like 20 years ago, this did not even exist at all. And I think that having to adapt to that is difficult. You know, it's challenging because our brains have not evolved to handle it. So, you know, having a problem with social media, whether it's you're addicted to it or it, you know, emotionally affects you in some profound way, I think that's normal. And I think it's something that, you know, people need help with, because it's not a natural thing that happens in the world. So again, this is something therapy can help with. And BetterHelp is a great place to access therapy. If you're thinking of starting, you know, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's convenient, it's flexible, it's suited to your schedule. What I liked about it is that it was fast. Like, I signed up and I was talking to somebody, you know, within the week, maybe even within a couple of days. And because, you know, when you feel like you need to talk to somebody, you want to talk to somebody. You don't want to wait like a month or 6 weeks or something. You want to talk to somebody now. So all you have to do, you fill out a brief questionnaire, you get matched with a licensed therapist.
You can switch at any time for no additional charge. They make it very, very easy. It's like an app on your phone. I used to go out and do it in my car, which was actually a nice place of solitude, and it was comfortable. So I recommend it. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Greg today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Greg.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Okay, we're back with Robbie Harris. I know, it's funny. It's a quick break.
We're seeing that.
It's amazing. A quick break. Before the break, we were talking about kind of what you do in these places. I want to talk a little bit about places you've been and your impressions of them, because that's interesting to me. Now, you've been in Iraq a bunch of times by now. You were there before, you were there after. I've kind of lost the plot there a little bit about what's going on the ground. So what is it like there now? Like, what, you know, who's in charge? Is it, I don't know anything about it at this point. It's lost on me.
I'm not sure I know. Okay. I haven't been in 2 years, but I will tell you this. I recently went to a conference and was sat at a table with 4 or 5 Iraqis who do various things for the government. I'm not even sure 100% what they do. But it was interesting because according to them, things have largely returned to normal. A very senior person was saying he walks around, and this sounds slightly crazy because in our world, this would be beyond the pale to even say this is symbol of security. But he said he's free to go out without escorts, without security escorts in the middle of the night if he wants to go for a walk and nobody bothers him. In Baghdad, that Mosul is thriving, which is the second largest city, and business is returning. And I believe it just came off some sort of list that of countries that are prone to have terrorist attacks in it. It's no longer at the top 10. And so the economy is returning and things, the security situation has settled down a lot. I think right now, though, there's still a bit of instability because of what's happening both between the U.S. and its neighbor Iran, and then also what's happening up in the Kurdish region, mm-hmm. going on with Turkey and Iran too. There's a lot happening up there in the U.S. But overall, you know, the past 20, 25 years, I mean, since things got really bad from like 2005 to 2007, it's much better.
That's good. That's good to hear. Yeah. So you mentioned, go ahead.
I think there's still economic issues. And for the youth, it's difficult to kind of find a path forward. But that is more to do with the structure of the society and less to do with security issues than it has been in the past.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Mosul. That I read this thing where, obviously, after the First World War, France and Britain drew up the boundaries of the Middle East and Sykes-Picot without really thinking about it that much. I think they just drew shit with a mark. It was like Trump drawing that with the Sharpie, you know? And so some of the allegiances in the regions don't match up. So what I think I have it right, where Mosul, which is in Iraq, has more in common with Aleppo, which is in Syria, than maybe it does with Baghdad, which is in Iraq. So maybe they didn't do the greatest job carving up the Middle East so much. But what, you know, talk a little bit about that, like how, because there's a lot of talk about colonization and colonizers now in the news. Like, how does that 100 whatever years later still play out in that region? That's a very broad question, but.
We might go into some territory here. I don't know if I feel confident to go into, but you're right. The Sykes-Picot Agreement. So if you look at Jordan, it's got this crazy arm on the map stuck out to the east of it. Well, it's because it connects it to Iraq, and they were both British colonies. And Syria was a French colony. Mm-hmm. So, and then the kingdom, the king of Jordan is from is a Hashemite king, which is actually from Saudi Arabia. That's all in T.E. Lawrence of Arabia. But I think, you know, where you see a lot of this affecting what's going on is you can see it playing out in the, sorry to go here, but in the Israel-Palestine issue, what's happening between Israel and Gaza. And a lot of it is legacy left over from that, but not just right after World War One, but then subsequently, you know, after that. Because honestly, in Iraq, the kings, they had a king, Faisal. He didn't stay very long. And then the same thing in Syria. He didn't stay very long. But here's that whole colonial legacy and sort of what happened in 1948, 1967 that drew some really interesting boundaries for Gaza, the West Bank, and Israel, and have kind of fed into what we're looking at today.
You know? Yeah. Because I was thinking about it in terms of the dictatorship. Mm. And one of the virtues of a dictatorship, you know, say what you will about dictatorships. No, but places that have like disparate people living in them, you know, mm-hmm. sometimes a dictator can join all the people together. Like in Yugoslavia under Tito, you know, that guy was horrible, but he held everything together. And as soon as he died, the country fell apart. So, you know, Saddam Hussein, well, he died sooner than maybe he would have otherwise. But after he goes, that party is holding everything together for better or worse. And then it becomes more chaotic. And into the chaos, I think projecting a kind of democracy there is complicated because you have these different groups of people who may not have much in common beyond the fact that they happen to be sharing the space that Britain drew up for them in, 1917 or whatever it was. So I just think it's interesting when, you know, to your point about how we project our own stuff onto places, like I think it's hard for us in the United States to appreciate what it's like to live in that way. And in a country like that, where, you know, the boundaries aren't set or fixed in the way that ours are. Not that ours are set or fixed in a great way either, but you know what I'm getting at.
I do. I mean, like if you look at some of the border areas between Syria and Iraq, and those tribes have more in common with each other than they do with their respective governments. Yeah. And after World War One, the Kurds were promised a state. They never got it. It got divided up between like six or seven different countries. And today we see, you know, what's come out of that. And so it's always quite messy when you start picking, I call it picking winners for another people. The United States has never done a very good job of that. We picked Chalabi for Iraq, a failure. Look at Afghanistan. We see how that's gone.
Yeah.
Not well at all, you know. And look at South America. And any time we've tried to pick a winner for someone else, it doesn't work because it's not grounded in the reality that people live in.
Yeah, yeah. What happened to the – there was talk at one point during the Iraq War, maybe in the early days, of there being like a three-state division there where the Kurds would get Kurdistan. Whatever happened with that? Is it just a non-starter now or –
No, it's kind of in a two-state separation at the moment, but it's Iraq is a federal region. So I'm sorry, Iraq, Kurdistan's a federal region, and they have their own government. But at the end of the day, the salaries, many of them are paid for from Baghdad.
Okay.
So there is a great deal of control. If the money doesn't come,
yeah,
then people don't get paid. And in the Middle East, at least up until about the 1990s, early 2000s, most people, if you wanted a good job, you worked for the government. And yeah. So a huge percentage of the population always works with government. And so if salaries aren't being paid, you have a lot of people going without. So it's a good control mechanism.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for that. Because I have no idea what's going on lately.
The Sunni region in the West always talks about maybe setting up a separate, you know, separate region, separate federal area. But to date, they've not done so. It's reported that they have a lot of gas there, mm-hmm. in terms of oil. And so therefore kind of economically be sustainable, but they'd have to figure out how to get it in and out and have to have someone to help them.
Yeah, I don't know that they can find anyone to help them get gas out of the region. I don't think anyone's ever tried to do that before.
Qataris, but they're a long way away.
So you mentioned Syria. This is another place. I know a little bit more about Syria, but Assad is still in power, which seems ridiculous. What happened there in your view? Because you have you were paying attention to it more than I was, certainly at that time. Obama's the president. There's a red line. The red line is crossed. Nothing happens. And then at one point, Russia gets involved. We get involved. Everybody's fighting ISIS. And it's this chaos. What's the deal there now? Again, the situation on the ground.
Again, I hope this what I'm going to say is helpful, but I'm not sure that it's going to be. I was working at USAID when this all started happening in Syria, and I was the only person at USAID who had ever actually lived in Syria. And when I wrote up my initial assessment, I mean, granted, I was young. I was in my, early to mid-30s, but I told them, I said, it's going to turn to be a proxy war, right? Like, this is what's going to happen. And they're like, no, it's not a civil war. It's not going to turn into that. I don't know. And then here we are, right?
Yeah.
And I think, honestly, that is what is continuing. We have this massive camp, Al-Hol. Do you know about Al-Hol?
No.
Refugee camp. So there is a refugee camp in northern Syria that the Kurds are largely responsible for managing, but are receiving very, probably not sufficient funds to do it. But it's full of both refugees, including Yazidi women who were captured by ISIS and who can't go home or haven't been processed to go home or don't want to go home. There's a whole other list of reasons why not. It includes ISIS families. It includes some ISIS prisoners and things like that. Well, a lot of these ISIS families, actually, not a lot. Some of them have other nationalities but don't want to go home. They're having children. These children have no nationalities, right? Because in Syria, mothers can't pass their nationality to their children. And many of these women come from Arab countries where they can't either, even though they're not Syrians. And you have this growing stateless population that is living in fairly dire circumstances. And some of them are being radicalized because of the propaganda that's being put in there from ISIS remnants. And, you know, what's going to happen to them? Because none of the European countries don't want to take them. Nobody wants to take them, right? Yeah. Syria doesn't want them. And so it's a problem. And then the countries that many, if they have home countries, they don't want to take them back because they feel they've been radicalized. Why they've been there, or they were radicalized. So we have this growing stateless population that has nowhere to go, no one quite controlling it, who are somewhat radicalized, which represents a huge problem. Iranian influence in the region is growing. So in Iraq was a predominantly Shia population led by a Sunni minority when Saddam was the dictator. In Syria was the opposite. It's a predominantly Sunni population led by a heterodox Shia leader, right? And so Iranian influence in the region is growing in places where you used to not see Shia mosques or Shia schools. You're now seeing those. You know, the U.S., it has created a place for Russia to go initially with the Wagner Group and to practice tactics and work. I mean, because you think where they are now, the Wagner Group or Africa Corps has now moved over to West Africa, but they were working and honing their skills there in Syria. And so really and truthfully, you know, the United States is geographically so far away. We've said, you know, we did a withdrawal from Iraq at some point. We're kind of in and out of there. And so it's really unclear where it's all headed.
It's a chaos, which is pretty much what I thought.
It is. And that refugee camp, and it's not the only one.
Yeah.
No, the international community does not have a solution for it.
Yeah, that sounds like powder keggy to me. It sounds like a problem. So where did you live when you were in Syria? Were you in Damascus or somewhere
else? I was in Damascus. I was. Yeah. And I lived there. And I lived on my own for a while. And for a little bit, I was doing research on Palestinian refugees in Syria. So I lived with a Palestinian refugee family for a little bit. And then had the wonderful opportunity to travel all around the country. But this was 2002 to 2003. This is very different, but it was beautiful. I mean, Aleppo, Palmyra, which no longer really exists anymore.
Yeah,
so sad. I just loved it.
I've had people on the show before and asked who have lived various places in the Middle East, where they would go and what's their favorite place. And I think everybody says Damascus. That's what, you know, so far. So. Is that what's your favorite place of the places you've been, lived, all that kind of stuff?
Oh, Greg, goodness. It's so hard.
Other than DuPont Circle in that bar, you know, other than, you know.
That was life changing, is all I can say. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So Oman is amazing. Mm-hmm. If you want to go to the Middle East and have a unique experience. And the desert in Jordan is just beautiful. Nothing compares to it. The night sky there is just incredible. And I loved Aleppo. I like Damascus, but I actually liked Aleppo better.
Okay.
It's so beautiful. And the city, Aleppo is so old, and the walled city and the market and the souk there and everything was just incredible. So those are my favorite places there. Outside of that, I love Southern Spain.
You're right. I'm talking about the place that, you know, I hope that everything settles down. And at some point in my life, I'll be able to go and visit these places in some sort of way that's safer than it is now. You know,
look, there was a young Englishman recently, probably a couple years ago, who is marking out, like he's doing trails mm-hmm. up in Kurdistan in the northern part of Iraq. And so he's marked out some trails where they have homestays all along the place. So you can do that now if you want.
I'm going to go with no. I think I'm going to pass. I think I'm just going to reluctantly, you know.
Say no. Take a few years on that.
I'm not really a hiker. I'm more of a city person. I like the cities. I like to hang in the cities, yeah. You know. So that's how it is. Now, another place you went or have been is Africa. And you've been to, what, Somalia, right? So how does that, what's that like there? And how does it compare to other places in the region?
Well, in Africa, I probably spent the most time in Niger and then in Somalia and a little bit in Mali. But Somalia is really strange. I mean, in the sense that I don't feel like I could honestly tell you what it's so much like because I was confined to the area near the airport.
Okay.
So there's almost like there's a green zone that's slammed up to the airport and then on the other side a little bit. And then there's the ocean. So unless you're going out with security, you don't really go out and go around very much.
Okay. Did you get to ride on a pirate ship? No, I'm just kidding.
No, but I may have seen a couple off the coast. I don't know.
So what's Niger like? Because there was a couple that time during the Trump administration where the soldiers died there. And I never really figured out or put together what the politics of the place was like or what we were doing there.
It's beautiful. I mean, I might be the only person on the planet to say that, but I really liked it. After working in the Middle East for so long, where a lot of the regional problems, rightly, somewhat wrongly sometimes, are laid at the feet of Americans. And everywhere you go, people look at you with this slight suspicion and a little bit of, and a dusting of hatred all the time.
Right. Yeah.
Until they get to know you, which you get used to. You're like, I know it's going to be about 6 months before we actually have a proper conversation. It's fine. I'm here for the long haul. We'll wait. But in Niger, there was a really good legacy of Peace Corps from the United States. And what this is about 2013 and what the U.S. government was doing there. And people actually really liked at the time, this before the coup, really liked Americans. And so I traveled all over the country working on setting up one of a USA project there. And no matter where we went, people were excited to see us and talk to us, and very hospitable, very kind, and very peaceful. A lot of poverty for sure. But every year, I get so excited about this, coolest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Okay.
Something on a National Geographic. They do this thing called Kirsale out in the eastern part of the country. And there's the Tuaregs who move goods and people and other things from licit and illicit from Libya all the way over to Mali. And that was one of the reasons why we were there, right? They also have uranium up in the northern part of the country, but the French have historically controlled that. The Tubus, who run the trade routes from northern Niger down to Nigeria, the Hausa, who kind of are everywhere, the Wodabe, who are the Fulani, who are the cattle herders who roam. Anyway, they all come together and they're all dressed in their finery and their, I don't want to say costumes, but the clothes that they wear for these things. And they bring their animals, and there are competitions and beauty competitions and camel races. And I don't know, you name it. And it's unique in the region because in other areas, those groups of people are constantly fighting.
Yeah.
And they would never get together like that. That's so beautiful.
Okay. I would never have thought that was the last place I thought we were going to go during this interview was there.
Sorry.
No, I'm glad. It's fun.
But there's this exciting thing that happens there, Greg. So in one of the groups of people, the Wodabe, at this instance, the men dance for the women and the women get to choose their partner for the time that they're there. And it's not, doesn't have to be their husband. So the men are dancing for the women pick the person and off they go for the remainder of the Kirsale. And then they go home with their partner, but not the one they picked there.
Wow. Okay. That's...
You just never know.
That's hip, man. That's...
It is. And the guys, when they dance, they are, I mean, they are all about it. You can tell they look sad sometimes if they don't get chosen.
Oh, it's like one of those things where it's a, you auction off the... The Bachelor or something like that. And then, you know,
yes,
nobody
bids. They
all
stand in a line and they're all dancing. And it's amazing.
Yeah. So wait, were you there for the dance or you just know about this?
No, I saw the dance. I took pictures. I've never seen anything like it in my life. The stamina, you know, constantly jumping up and down to do that for hours on end.
Okay.
The facial expressions, everything, just incredible.
But you were just an observer. You didn't get to, you didn't get to choose.
I wasn't picking. No.
Okay.
No, not allowed. I was there on official business. Not permitted. Not allowed, Greg.
Moving on. back to the Middle East. I've been wanting to have a sip of water since you told the story about the women in the water, the women in the wells. Now, since you know about ISIS. Which is in the news, because now I want to ask about this. As we're talking about this, it's a couple days after the terrorist attack in Moscow, which is horrifying, obviously, and we don't have to go into the details of it. But ISIS, something called ISIS-K, claim responsibility for it, which if Putin says so, we just roll our eyes. But apparently that's been confirmed by the State Department and the CIA. So my question really is, why are they there? Why would they care to do that? And what is ISIS-K? It sounds like a 895 veers off Interstate 95 or something. Is it?
Well, it does. My first thought is what they're doing there. It says they're from the Khorasan province, right? Which is Afghanistan. So, I mean, I don't know that Afghans and Russia have such a lovely relationship at all.
Yeah.
There's that historically.
Yeah.
And the broader ISIS global picture, they are quite active in Africa, actually, and very, at least branches of them are. And I don't know if this is related or not, but the Wagner Group, renamed the Africa Corps, is in several countries now, trying and basically in conflict with these terrorist organizations, some of which are connected back to ISIS. So it could be related to that. Could be related to the very bad relationship that the Russians and the Afghans have.
Or it could be nothing, and it's just bullshit. So I don't know. You can never tell with what comes out of Russia, in my opinion.
You don't know.
We don't know. Okay, I've got one more question for you. Now, we talked at the beginning about these strategic communications and behavior change. We have, in this country that we live in now, the United States of America, we have a problem where a good percentage of the population has drunk the MAGA Kool-Aid and believes stuff that is palpably, provably not true. And what you did with regards ISIS is pump in information that is true. So using your, if you were coming to the United States as an expert, but you didn't live here and you were just looking at it objectively, what would you advise us to do? Like from a messaging standpoint, from a, any tips would be welcome because people listening will do them.
Well, I think initially, you know, one thing I would say is, I mean, I come from a very conservative community, and anytime I try to make a point using facts or Bible verses, which I do sometimes, my Bible's pretty good. If I give five facts or five verses, I get 10 facts and 10 verses thrown back at me, and people really dig in their heels. So I would say that the logic approach is not going to work.
Yeah.
Because people are not operating from a sense of logic. They're operating more from emotions. I think there needs to be a combination. I think we need to start getting people together from both sides, Republicans and Democrats, or independents, Republicans, Democrats, and people need to start. I don't know how this happens, right? But people need to start doing things together, having a beer together. A lot of conservatives don't drink, so fine, that's not it. But something, doing something together, right? And we need to turn these into social media pieces, and we need to start talking about it. And we need to start talking about what it means to be America, or what it means to be American, right? And what are the values that we hold dear? Because you look at the polls and people are favoring violence, especially 18 to 30 year olds, you know, from everything from if someone attacks me, I don't get what I want at the polls. It doesn't come out right. So violence is an acceptable solution. About 30% of respondents have said this. And I don't think people realize what that means.
Yeah.
And I think that we are prone to hyperbole in this country. And I think that we are really stuck in our echo chambers on our social media spaces. And I think anything that can remind us of who we are at our core, what it means to actually be American. And yes, there are differences on that for the right and the left, but there is a core that remains the same. And that is, we value the right to share our opinion. Mm-hmm. We value the right to live our lives how we want to live them, right? And you could go on and you can extract from this. And people are talking about democratic norms, but what does that mean? Nobody knows, because for most of us, democracy has been a spectator sport. We expect it's just going to keep ticking over and keep rolling over because it always has, or we don't care if it does because we don't know what it means if it doesn't. And so I think, you know, part of it is reminding people, get involved in the process, participate, go work at the polls, see how they work. If you think they're not working right, go volunteer. See what's going on, you know, reminding people that it's not just me who has a right to live how I want to live. It's the other person. Reminding people, all of us, of who we are and the things we like about being American. I mean, like, because I hate to say this, maybe I shouldn't, but if there is this violent response tension to what happens after the elections, you know, kiss March Madness and the Super Bowl goodbye. Those things don't happen in the middle of a civil war. Your Starbucks is gone and your Walmart is gone and your gas under $5 a gallon is gone. And people are glibly throwing these things around. And I hear it from both sides, right? Well, maybe we should. And I'm like, you don't know what that means and you don't really mean it. We need to introduce ourselves to one another. We need to talk to one another. We need to spend time with one another, even just a little bit. And we need to talk about it more broadly. And we need to focus on the good things that are happening because everybody's looking at the negative.
That's a really good answer. Thank you for make me feel more hopeful. Even though, you know, I'm not going to lie, I don't necessarily want to spend time with people that hate me so much. But, you know, we got to do something because I think your point is what it means if it doesn't work out, if democracy falls. What does that mean? So I said that was the last question, but and you sort of alluded to it a little bit with March Madness going away and the Super Bowl and everything. But what does it mean? What's something that people don't think about when they think or they take for granted in our democracy that would fall and make everybody really mad?
Just affect your daily life. Your ability to walk outside of your house, get in your car, drive down the street and pick up your McDonald's, your Chick-fil-A, your Starbucks, whatever it is you want in the morning with nobody harassing you, not having to go through armed checkpoints, not having to pay off someone at a checkpoint, not wondering if they're going to shoot your daughter, your son, and knowing that you will get there and be able to purchase what you want and come home safely. Having football games with, you know, with the local teams that your kids play with, having baseball games, your kids being able to go to college, go on trips to go look at colleges, your kids even being able to go to school, your daughter being able to walk down the street in the midst of not having a safe society and a stable society. Those things aren't happening. I've lived in places where they don't, and you don't. I've been stopped at checkpoints and guns pointed at me. People ask me who I am and where I'm going. And kid, it's a 16-year-old kid with his finger on the trigger. Say boo and he might shoot you because he's not trained, right? So do you really want militias running your intersections? I don't think so.
Yeah, that's also a very good answer.
Sorry, I mean, you asked, but these are the things.
No, this is what I want. Because I think it's important that I talk about this a lot on the show, about what happens if democracy falls, what does a fascist society look like? How would it play out in the United States? And there's things that I know based on what Trump will do and what he said he'll do and what his, you know, the radical Catholic Leonard Leo clan wants to do and that kind of thing. But there's sort of mundane day-to-day things that I think we all take super for granted. Same thing with NATO, by the way. You know, if NATO collapses, that's where, you know, it's...
It's the thing, right? People say, oh, well, if democracy collapses, I won't be able to vote. I'm like, when was the last time you actually voted anyway? Now, I know, Greg, you probably vote. I recently started working at the polls and I love it. And I get my text and they say, go vote. So I go and I vote, right? But a lot of my friends don't vote. So for them, telling them they're not going to have the right to vote, the idea of it, shocking. But most Americans don't vote.
Yeah.
What does it mean? You can't go to your city council member and tell them what you think? Most people don't do that either. We use democracy like a spectator sport. It benefits us. So we just kind of hang back and let it happen until it doesn't. And then we're all worried about it. That's why I say, talk about the realities of what happens if this doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. We won't be able to get my that. Now you made me, I actually went to McDonald's drive-thru for my kid before this thing. So I was not harassed at a checkpoint. Nobody pointed a gun in my face. I did get what I wanted. I don't think they screwed the order up, although sometimes they do. A shamrock shake was part of the order.
Oh my goodness. You see, no more green shamrock shakes.
No more. No. Yeah. We don't want to know what they're going to put in the shamrocks. There's going to be no regulation of what's in these things too. Even if we get it, it's going to be like, what's in the burger? You know,
trash doesn't get picked up. You got to figure out what to do with it. I mean, these very mundane things. Be like, I don't want to pay taxes. I'm like, great. So you're going to patch up the road when it breaks.
Yeah. Taxes is a bad word, too. You're paying for services. That's what you're paying for. You're pooling your money so that you're getting stuff.
Greg, I pretend all my taxes go to the National Park Service. I love the National Park Service. It makes paying my taxes so much sweeter.
There you go. National Park Service. Yeah. Which I prefer the National Park Service to the trails in Kurdistan. I just, you know, I'm going to say, I haven't even been to the, I don't even go to the park that's up the road. You know, I'm going to go to Kurdistan.
The National Park Service has a passport. You can take it with you and get little stamps in it. It's great. It makes me feel very well traveled in the U.S.
It's good. So are you on social media? Are you, can people follow you on the site formerly known as Twitter, or are you just not, you know, you're not there?
I'm not on Twitter.
Okay.
I have an Instagram account. I think I do.
Okay. So you're not, you deploy social media, but you're not on social media. So, okay.
Mm-mm.
Okay. So you've got nothing to plug. Nobody can find you. Too bad. You have to come through me. This has been delightful. Robbie Harris, thanks so much for taking the time with me today.
Thank you, Greg.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fossa. Serena Zabriskie, Marie Cast, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, Kimberly Johnson, and everyone else at MSW Media. If you'd like to support this program, get three friends to subscribe. The more downloads I get, the better the show does. You can also subscribe to The 5-8, the live YouTube show I do with my friend Stephanie Koff, a.k.a. LB. Tune in tonight for your Friday night hang. Most importantly, please subscribe to The Prevail Substack, with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $6 monthly or $55 yearly subscription funds my work on the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely, be kind to each other, try and enjoy yourself, and until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.
I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.